The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What's the protein content of a grasshopper?
You know, statistically, they say that pound for pound, dried grasshoppers are about the same as lean ground beef when it comes to protein. But you're also getting all these vitamins and minerals and amino acids, and they're very low in fat compared to ground beef. So they're a good deal.
Welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors who write from and about the Western United States. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with David G. Gordon about the Eat a Bug Cookbook. You state many reasons in this book about why eating bugs is a good idea. And they're, as you said, high in protein and minerals, for one. But you also say it's good for the environment. How
yeah,
so?
You know, the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN released a report last year where they were talking about this. You know, our populations are growing so rapidly, we probably will not be able to sustain them on our conventional forms of agriculture, say, 40 years from now. So instead of offering everyone a hamburger, they should actually be looking at raising and eating insects. They're much easier to raise because they don't require nearly as much food or water resources or land to farm them. So that's a really good way to go. That's just one reason why I believe they're good for the environment. Of course, if we were eating some of the garden pests rather than spraying them with chemicals, that would be a wonderful thing too. We'd have to use considerably less in the way of pesticides for that. Also, we're talking about diversity. You know, we've kind of overfished our oceans. I think people pretty much agree on that. And we're very focused on maybe five or six different sources of protein, you know, chicken and beef and pork and turkey and, you know, the really conventional forms, salmon. If we actually diversified and tried eating lots of other different kinds of things, including insects, we'd probably have a much lighter footprint on our planet.
I was really blown away by the statistics that you have in the book, in the introduction. 2,600 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of beef?
I know, it's really kind of obscene. And also this whole notion of converting food. I think it takes about somewhere between 12 and 16 pounds of grain when they're feeding cattle to get 1 pound of beef. So that's not very good turnover. It's almost a one-to-one ratio with some insects. So, you know, we give them 1 pound of food, you're going to get 1 pound of insects in return. But that 16 pounds of grain, you could actually feed a whole village in Indonesia with that.
And 18% of greenhouse gas emissions, according to a study that was done by some Dutch scientists, came from cattle and pig poop.
That's right. Cow flatulence and manure, that's really, it lets off a lot of methane gas into our environment. It goes up into the upper atmosphere. It forms a layer. It lets light in through it, but it doesn't let heat radiate back out. That's why they call it the greenhouse effect. It's like having glass panes in a greenhouse. And I was amazed when I read that cows actually contribute a higher percentage of greenhouse gases than all the cars in the world combined. Cars and trucks and motorcycles. That's a lot.
Another part of that study concluded that we could reduce those greenhouse gases by 60% if we did, as you wrote, grasshopper ranching instead of cattle ranching.
Yes, that's right. And that might be heresy in Montana to be talking about this, although I know there's plenty of grasshoppers here too.
I'm not sure where they would live and how we would keep them on the land they're supposed to be on in the wintertime. Where would they live?
Well, the nice thing is, and actually Montana is probably not the best place to do this because of the cold winters, but you can basically have, like, let's say a Quonset hut or a temporary storage area as long as it's heated, and raise things like crickets or mealworms or grasshoppers. Or in Europe, they actually farm locusts, which is kind of wild. You know, locusts, if you read the Bible, are actually listed as kosher foods. So they say all the rest are an abomination, but you're okay if you're eating locusts.
In the book, you mentioned locust protein powder. So I thought, well, maybe that's where somebody could start eating insects that could add the locust protein powder to their smoothie.
Yeah, that's right. There's actually a couple of companies now that are making cricket flour. They take crickets, first of all, they freeze them, that kills them. Then they bake them in an oven, like spread them on a cookie sheet till they're dried, grind them up, and they get this very high protein powder out of that that can be mixed with conventional flour. There's a restaurant in Seattle where I live that is now, it's an Indian restaurant. They're making chapatis with crickets in them, and they're quite tasty.
Do you and your wife eat insects?
We do. We don't eat them every day. It's not like I get up in the morning and have a bowl of grasshoppers. But we have a lot of, I'm always trying new recipes. You know, my cookbook has, the original book had 33 recipes. This new book has 40. And I'm also oftentimes having guests over. And it's funny, tides have turned. And they've gone from the what are you serving with great qualms to kind of a great enthusiasm. What are we going to eat today? So yeah, about at least once or twice a week, I'm out there cooking away.
Yeah, I would say being a guest at your house is probably an adventure.
Yeah, you know, I was raised to think asking what's for dinner is rude if you've been invited over, you know. But in my case, it's warranted.
You talk to school kids a lot about eating bugs. What's their reaction to this?
You know, I'm really amazed. I used to do lots of school assemblies. I've sort of scaled back on that lately just because it's like stand-up comedy. If you lose your audience for a minute, you're really in trouble. But for the most part, kids are very enthusiastic. They're actually more adventurous, I think, than their parents. A lot of times I get parents after the programs who say, you know, I couldn't get him to eat anything, and here he is volunteering to eat a scorpion. What's the secret? And I'm sort of thinking, well, you probably aren't serving exotic fare like scorpions in your home. But it's also interesting to me when I do a school assembly, a lot of the kids, it's like, you know, sort of the herd effect. They're very strongly influenced by the first couple of people who come up to sample something. And if they think it's cool and exciting, then I get this sea of hands. Me, pick me. But if the first guys, maybe they've seen Fear Factor too much, so they act like it's a big ordeal, then that kind of kills the program for everybody.
Most people in North America and Europe don't want to see heads and feet on their animals in the store or on their tables. They want things in presentable chunks that they don't recognize as animals that used to walk around and look at things.
Yeah, it needs to be shrink-wrapped and put on a little styrofoam platter for people, rather than seeing a whole salmon, for example.
Yeah.
And actually, I joke about this. When you go to a Chinese restaurant and they bring out the whole fish, then everyone at the table sort of sits there and stares at it until the waiter comes over and starts slicing it up for you. But people you're right, they don't know what to do with that. That's probably a reason that the things like cricket powder might become a better alternative.
Yeah, we have beautiful photographs of the recipes in this book, and the food looks gorgeous, but then there's a cricket or a bumblebee sitting on top of the side dish, or a grasshopper skewered for
right.
a kebab with his legs and everything sticking out.
Yeah. You know, when I wrote my book, that was in 1998 originally, and when I wrote it, I made a real conscious decision that I didn't want to mask the fact that people were eating insects. I kind of wanted to challenge them to man up and try these bugs just the way they are. So I didn't bury them in complex sauces or over-season them. But over the years, I've actually learned that some of the most popular dishes are ones where you can kind of tell it's an insect, but you're not really worried that it's looking back at you. So, for example, I have a recipe in this new edition that's for a deep-fried tarantula spider. The preparation involves putting it in tempura batter and then deep-frying it. So what comes out looks like food. It could actually be a donut or something. But, of course, there's a spider in there. And people have an easier time with that than actually looking at the spider itself.
Yeah, there's something about the legs.
Well, it's really weird. We actually, in our culture, we have a culture of bug bashers.
Mm-hmm.
We think that insects are germy and gross and disgusting, which I don't think any of that is true. And other cultures don't necessarily feel that way. In Japan, for example, kids have pet beetles. And when the beetle dies, they take it outside and bury it. There's a little ceremony. You know, and here in the United States, if you wanted to bring a beetle into the house, you better have a very progressive parent watching over you, because usually they'll say, get that thing out of here. So there's almost like a PR campaign that's needed to get people to understand without insects, our planet would pretty much shut down in a matter of weeks. They provide so many functions. They're food for other animals. They're pollinators, of course. They're recyclers of nutrients. They get dead stuff back into the soil. We really need them. But we almost go out of our way to enjoy bashing them. And actually, the best guess I have, I've never found a definitive answer to this, but I believe because we're so invested in agriculture, insects are the only animals on our planet that really are in direct competition with people. If a swarm of locusts comes by in your wheat field, you're in trouble. So I'm sure there's a lot of kind of fear-mongering among pesticides companies and things like that. But also, admitting that insects taste good is like sleeping with the enemy, maybe.
Yeah, we're just not used to it. As kids, we didn't grow up seeing insects on our table and taught that the slugs out in the garden are competing with us for our tomatoes.
That's right. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because we eat all sorts of weird stuff in our own cuisine. But if your parents or your grandparents served it to you, that's a comfort food.
Right.
And, you know, when I do my programs, I have a rubber chicken that I travel with. And I hold up this rubber chicken. I go, what's so glamorous about eating one of these? In fact, I say, there are actually people in this very room who actually eat what comes out of the bottom of the chicken. Well, of course, everyone gasps at that. And then I have to say, how many of you had eggs for breakfast? And then a lot of hands go up. But, you know, the idea of chicken eggs is actually quite weird when you think about it. But, you know, if I said we're going to have turtle eggs tomorrow, everyone would protest.
You also write about the fact that we eat bugs even though we don't know we're eating bugs. We're already eating bugs.
Yeah, that's because the Food and Drug Administration has actually set allowable limits on the numbers of bugs that can be in certain products. So things like bean dishes or peanut butter or jams and jellies, they've kind of realized that it's impossible to completely exclude bugs from those foods. Chocolate, for example, actually has bugs in it. So someone actually calculated with those allowable limits and a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, there can be something like 56 bug parts. And someone told me a story once, which I think is really hilarious, about tomato ketchup. If you look at the bottle, there's that little ring around the neck of the bottle. And that's left over from the good old days when they made ketchup. There were bugs in there, and they weren't very good at processing everything. So the bugs would rise to the surface, and it looked kind of gritty and gross. So someone in advertising, no doubt, put a little paper band around the neck to conceal that. The first person to use the ketchup would get all that glop, and then everything was fine. So the band is still there, even though we have the technology to make that not so unsightly.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman. David G. Gordon is here, and we're talking about his book titled The Eat a Bug Cookbook. If you tuned in late or would like to share this program with a friend, you'll find audio online at mtpr.org/twq and on our Facebook page. After a short break, we'll be back to talk about cricket recipes and hear what not to do when cooking bugs. Don't go away. Thank you. You also write in the book that, is it a 1 to 20 rule?
Oh, yeah. If you're going to be harvesting insects, well, we like to think that they're abundant and, you know, an infinite resource. They're not. And actually, if you look at our own country's Endangered Species Act, a lot of the endangered or threatened species are invertebrates, insects and snails and things like that. They're very susceptible to hand picking or to habitat change. So I say if you see 20 of them, you can take one. That's kind of the 1 in 20 rule.
American Indians, some of the tribes that lived on the plains, used to harvest bugs that came flying by at certain times of the year. And we like to think of them as people who went out and shot bison and used bison for their main source of protein. But you say that's not necessarily true.
That's right. And actually, I read a statistic recently that said 80% of the world's cultures actually eat insects in their regular daily routine. We're kind of the weirdos because we're in that 20% that does not.
Well, would you mind reading that short passage? It's titled Beating the Bush for Big Bugs.
Oh, yeah. Not at all. You know, it says Orthoptera, which, by the way, is the fancy word for grasshoppers and katydids and crickets. It says Orthoptera, not bison, was the seasonal mainstay of many plains tribes. Harvesting the abundant stocks was often a communal effort, with entire villages, men, women, and children, working together to flush the six-legged game. Here's a quote here. They begin by digging a hole 10 or 12 feet in diameter by 4 or 5 feet deep, wrote Father Pierre-Jean Desmet, describing the tactics of a Shoshone in the 1800s. Then, armed with long branches of Artemisia, they surround a field of 4 or 5 acres, more or less, according to the number of people who are engaged in it. I love the way people wrote back then, don't you? They stand about 20 feet apart, and their whole work is to beat the ground so as to frighten up the grasshoppers and make them bound forward. They chase them toward the center by degrees, that is, into the hole prepared for their reception. Their number is so considerable that frequently 3 or 4 acres furnish grasshoppers sufficient to fill the reservoir or hole. That's a lot. This Orthopteran bounty could be hastily hand-picked and stuffed into sacks, which were then soaked in salt water and, how convenient, tossed into an oven for 10 or 15 minutes. Other tribes built large fires in their insect-catching pits, creating a bed of coals on which to roast any grasshoppers headed that way. Some tribes simply torched the grasslands and returned once the fires had died down to pluck the flame-broiled insects. The potential of the various harvest techniques was nicely illustrated by entomologist David Madsen, who, with the help of a few peers, rounded up Mormon crickets along the Utah-Colorado border. Two sweeps of the underbrush brought in batches of 5,652 and 9,876 crickets for an average catch of nearly 18.5 pounds. A pound of dried Mormon crickets contains about 1,270 calories, so the nutritional rewards from such a catch were quite large. In 1 hour, Madsen's team had amassed the caloric equivalent of 43 Big Macs, 49 slices of pizza, and 89 chili dogs. And yes, I had to do the math on that one myself.
So let's say a person decides to start eating insects, bugs. What are some of the rules they should adhere to?
Well, I like to warn people, first of all, to not harvest out of their backyards or under their refrigerators, because those bugs, there's a high likelihood they've been subjected to pesticides. Even if you're an organic gardener, there's no guarantee that your neighbors are. So when you eat insects that have pesticides in them, you become what's known as a bioaccumulator. The pesticides stay in our fatty tissues, and the more we eat, the more that pesticide load builds up until we can actually become sick from that. So I always tell people to either buy bugs that have been raised to be eaten, and there are a lot of them out there, or to go far enough away from civilization that you don't have to worry about someone's just come by and sprayed a crop. I order boxfuls of scorpions from a gentleman in Arizona, and he goes out into the Sonoran Desert. So I know those guys have not been subjected to chemicals anyway. The other thing I tell people is to make sure that the bugs are thoroughly cooked. It's unlikely that they harbor parasites that would live in us, but in some cases they do. And you don't want to be subject to, a parasitic worm or something like that that's using the insect as an intermediate host. Once it's inside of you, then it starts to really have a good time. So, of course, cooking those, not freezing them, but cooking them, actually will destroy the parasites or any germs, for that matter, that are in the bugs.
So just going out and plucking bugs off of bushes and popping them in your mouth is not the way to go about this.
I used to tell the school kids that if someone came up to you on the playground and said, I'll give you a dollar if you eat that beetle, then you say, well, I'd be happy to do that, but first I must cook it.
So what else should people watch out for or be aware of if they're going to start using bugs in their dishes at home?
Well, the only other precautionary thing I would mention is that some people are allergic to bugs. And, you know, that's sort of like, well, how would I know if I hadn't eaten them before? Usually those same people are allergic to shellfish, things like shrimp or lobster. So if you've gone out and had a, you know, all-you-can-eat shrimp feed and then you feel really itchy or your throat is compressing and you're having a hard time getting your breath, that's a sign of an allergic reaction to those shrimp. And you'd probably have a similar reaction to things like grasshoppers.
You also write about some of the colored bugs you should stay away from.
Yeah, if you think about it, it makes common sense. An insect that's delicious to eat is going to want to hide and conceal itself. So a brown or a green or a black bug is probably fair game. Sometimes you see insects, though, that are really brightly colored. Caterpillars, for example, have alternating red and black stripes. In the insect world, that means leave me alone, I don't taste good. So stay away from those really gaudy bugs. You know, probably the easiest one to describe that effect is a ladybug or ladybird beetle. They're bright red with black spots. And if you watch birds, they won't eat them, even when they're in great abundance, because they're very bitter tasting.
So what would be a good dish for somebody to start out with? And where would they get the crickets or the grasshoppers to put in it?
You know, I think crickets are actually sort of the coin of the realm because they're available year-round. They're not a seasonal fare. You can buy them from pet stores or bait and tackle shops. Now, I know you're going to think, well, gee, they're not really raised for human consumption. But I'll have to tell you, when you buy insects from a pet store, people are buying those to feed things like iguanas or chameleons that might have cost them hundreds of dollars. So the bugs are actually kept in pretty hygienic conditions before they're actually shipped out to market. So I used to tell people, just go to your local Petco or PetSmart or what have you and pick up a bunch of crickets or mealworms to get started. Nowadays, last 5 years or so, there's been a real interest among younger people. It seems like a lot of college startup businesses and things like that in supplying edible insects. So there actually are several companies that now make organic insects that are raised solely for human consumption. One I can think of is called World Entomophagy, and they're in Austin, Texas. So they can actually provide you with sort of semi-pre-cooked bugs in packets. What I used to do is order maybe 1,000 or 2,000 crickets from a cricket farm. Actually, I use one in Louisiana. Well, that means an enormous box gets dumped on my doorstep full of crickets. I'd have to put that into a freezer, and then actually, after everybody's frozen solid, go and sort them out, make sure everything was tidy before I could cook them. Well, World Entomophagy is saving you that hassle.
It seems like a good companion business to people who are doing small startup farms. If they are doing organic farming, they might be able to do a little bug business on the side.
That's right. You know, well, I talk about this in my book, how a lot of the garden pests, you know, if instead of spraying them with pesticides, you could be getting two crops for the same acre of land. And in Japan, they do that with grasshoppers in rice paddies. They're actually called rice hoppers. And you can buy those in cans and teriyaki sauce. Yeah. So that might be a good way to go.
I've eaten chocolate-covered ants, and they were good, but they tasted like chocolate.
Yeah, I'll eat anything with chocolate on it myself.
Well, let's talk about crickets. You have a Chirpy Chex party mix. Let's just talk about what's in that and how you would go about preparing it.
Well, that's kind of like a standard Chex mix, a Super Bowl snack, if you will. And the recipes for those are usually right on the packages of the cereal. But I do talk about, you know, my own little version of that. The real trick is matching the ingredients to the size of the bugs so that you're not going to overshadow them. But to add in crickets, I actually freeze them, spread them on a cookie sheet after they've been defrosted, and put them into the oven at a very low temperature, maybe around 225, for about half an hour. And then they're good to go. So all I'm doing after that is seasoning them and mixing them in with the Chex Mix.
You say if you want to remove the crickets' legs, antenna, and ovipositors, is that?
Yeah, that's the little tubes on their butts where they lay eggs.
Then you put the baked crickets in a clean brown paper bag and shake it, so all those little bits will fall off.
You know, I learned that trick from the Insectarium in New Orleans. It's a really wonderful facility that has its own Bug Appetit Cafe. And they serve thousands of people over the course of a weekend, so they actually want to be very persnickety. I don't have a problem with the legs. As a matter of fact, there's some good meat in those legs. But if you really want to just have little bite-sized morsels, that's a good way to go. And I have one dish called Orthopteran Orzo. Mm-hmm. It's crickets and orzo pasta. And that's been a wildly popular dish. I was written up in Time magazine once. They said it was my signature dish. Then that made me feel like a celebrity chef to have a signature dish. But what I love to tell people is I actually was doing a program and I had one kid who just came back for more and more. Yeah, I think he had like fifths and then started working on sixths of this dish. And I felt a little bit like W.C. Fields, you know, get out of here, kid, you bother me. I said, don't they feed you at home? And this kid said, this is way better than anything my mom ever made.
Yikes.
I said, don't use that line at home, Sonny.
Well, it's a very beautiful dish. There's a photograph of it, and it looks wonderful. And then I see the little heads of the bugs sticking up.
Yeah, you're going to have to get over that one.
I think
Beth has sautéed crickets. You know, crickets are great because you can use them in so many different ways. The only thing you need to watch, and this is true with a lot of insects, is when you're cooking them, you know, they have a lot of moisture inside of them, but their body armor is pretty much sealing in everything. It actually even goes into their breathing holes and over their eyes. So steam starts to build up, and you can actually watch like a caterpillar inflate like a balloon and then burst. Make sure you're wearing an apron when that happens. So you want to make sure your crickets, I like to use a wok because I can move them in and out of the heat pretty easily and not have to deal with that popcorn effect. Yeah, thank you for sharing.
Yeah, it's an incredible visual. Thank you, David. David G. Gordon lives in Seattle. You'll find more information about him and the Eat a Bug Cookbook, as well as links to our podcast and Facebook page at mtpr.org/TWQ. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. Music for this program was written and performed by John Floridis. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/TWQ. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.